Good evening, everybody. Is this working in the back? Everybody here? I'm Roger Pasquier. I chair the New York Book Award, so I'm delighted to welcome you and so happy that the weather is not what it was this morning when I thought perhaps nobody would get here. I thought I would start by telling you what the process is for these awards, because the winners will surely want to know, and perhaps the rest of you will as well. Every year, we have found that there are between 150 and 250 books published about New York on every range of conceivable and inconceivable topic, fiction and nonfiction. And we feel we need to go through all of them to find the things that are most appropriate for awards. And we look for books that will give insight into an aspect of New York life, past or present, and will be enjoyed by the library members. And thanks to Jenny Lawrence, this is our second year where we have a special award for authors who are publishing their first book. But we have no fixed subject, so that we, some years, and here are all the books that we have awarded prizes to in past years, we're not obliged, like the poor people who deal with the Pulitzers or the Nobels, to come up with something even when they don't feel the prospects are very good. So we have complete freedom in the topics that we can reward. And our jury experience helps us separate the authoritative and the original from the derivative and the error-filled. And we have every book is read by at least one juror, and the ones that we think are promising, by the time we get to the semifinals and certainly the finals, we have everybody on the jury read those books. And the members of the committee are all listed in your program, and perhaps you have read some of the books that we have written. All of the members of the committee are active in one or another aspect of the New York literary world as authors, editors, journalists, or publishers. So today we're going to start with some remarks by Ellen Eisman, a trustee of the library who has generously sponsored the New York Book Awards this year and the last few years. The committee and the entire library are grateful to her for enabling us to honor writers and who celebrate and enlighten us about New York and the vitality and rich history that our city has. After Ellen speaks, we will have the awards, and three members of the jury will be introducing each of the award winners. Meg Wolitzer will start with our hornblower winner, Alex Gilvary. Meg is the author of 10 novels, including The Interestings, which came out earlier this year, and you've probably seen the rave reviews for that. Peter Salwin will introduce Joe McHenry. Peter is a writer, the author of Upper West Side Story. He's also a painter and a leader of architectural and historic walking tours of the city. And then I will introduce James and Carla Murray for the final book. And I feel a little bit like Ed Sullivan this year, because I must say we have a really good show, because this year we have two award winners whose books are so visual that we're having visuals as well as words this year. So, Ellen, let me have you come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger, for those very, very kind words. I'm delighted to sponsor the 2012 Book Awards. The jury's efforts reflect the standards and aims of this venerable library, shedding light on books of quality and, in the process, encouraging reading and scholarship. I need not tell this audience that we live in an age when the value of the traditional book is being questioned, and that it is harder than ever to persevere as an aspiring writer or as an experienced one, and bring deserved attention to your creativity, craft, and dedication. Jury prizes from respected institutions offer a valuable vehicle to advance this goal. With that in mind, I wanted to be supportive. As in years past when I've lent my name to the library's awards, I've felt a special interest in books about my hometown, where my great-great-grandparents grew up and six generations of my family have lived here. New York City has, of course, unlimited depths to plumb, and this library, as you know, has holdings that relate to the city's earliest history. With these awards, New York is further celebrated. I am grateful to play a small part in this undertaking, and I look forward to watching new books feted and authors applauded this evening and long into the limelight. Thank you.
You would think that the world of fiction writing and the world of fashion design have very little in common, but you would be wrong. Consider this. A first novelist only gets one chance to make that first impression when strutting down the long catwalk that is the printed page. A poorly rendered critical scene in a novel, just like an unflattering neckline, can ruin everything. But when a novel is done well, the reader, not unlike a celebrity sitting beside Anna Wintour in the first row of a tent at Fashion Week, leans back happily and submits to the vision of the new artist in town, which is pretty much what the reader does when reading Alex Gilvary's satiric, pungent, dexterous, and highly original first novel from the memoirs of a non-enemy combatant. This book is the first-person narrative of a Filipino immigrant named Boy Hernandez who arrives in New York City in the year 2002 with a big desire to make it as a fashion designer. In a sense, this novel is a love letter to New York, but if you're at all familiar with W.H. Auden's poem, The More Loving One, you'll surely remember the lines, "If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me." And from the moment that Boy arrives in our city, he is the one in rapture. Now, here's the point at which I was going to read in this really lyrical, kind of poetic voice, a long section from Alex Gilvary's novel. But right before the ceremony began, something just went into my head, and I said to him, we just met, I said, "You're not reading anything, are you?" And he, of course, said he was. And I said, "Oh, okay, well, I'm sure it's not the same section that I'm reading. It's not where he arrives in New York." And he said, "Yes." And he said, "But," he said, "you go ahead and read it." And I said, "No, no, no." He said, "No, you read it, and then I'll read it again." And I absolutely could not do this. So this is a very, very short speech, but I will say it's at least better than when I went to Breadloaf, the writers' conference, many, many years ago. John Gardner gave a reading, and John Gardner, being the way he was, got to like the fifth page of his reading, and page five was missing, and he went, "Oh, all right, well, they just sort of walk around a while, and then they go and have dinner. Okay, page six." So it was... just trying to do something as suave as that. So what I'm going to read is the one line that Alex very, very generously gave me to read from this, which is when a boy arrives in New York and is sort of looking out over the water. "I leaned my torso over the railing so I could see Lady Liberty. She was in mourning. A black veil covered her face." According to the footnote on this page, and footnotes are used really cleverly in this novel, David Foster Wallace had nothing on you, the black veil refers to the fact that the Statue of Liberty was undergoing restorations at the time. But this being 2002, the presence of the veil has a more resonant meaning, and while Boy Hernandez is ecstatic about his new home, the highly lovable and now fragile city does not love him back, or at least the U.S. government, still in its first flush of 9/11 frenzy and paranoia, takes Boy for a terrorist and ships him far from the skyscrapers and parks and pretzel vendors and fashion district and off to Guantanamo. Gilvary writes as smartly about these matters as he does about form mannequins. His ability to go high and low, looking at life in the city and the world as it was lived in the aftermath of 9/11, while still keeping irony alive and well, something we were assured in those early days was going to die an instant death, owes a small debt, at least indirectly, to earlier absurdist novels such as Catch-22. Here, the writer keeps an eye on wartime madness, even as he also keeps an eye on the latest style trends. We have good reason to hope, in fact, that From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant does in itself herald a style trend, at least for its author, the very talented Alex Gilvary, who has only just shown us the very beginnings of what he can do. We anticipate his return next season, whenever that season may be, and surely we will all be there, heads tipped up in the very first row. So congratulations.
Thank you for this so much. We both have really good taste. We picked the same passage to do. I want to thank the New York Society Library for giving me this award. It's truly an honor to be recognized, to be read. and to be considered a New York writer because I'm from here. I've always had an endless fascination with the city. It continually feeds my imagination. So I'm incredibly honored to be tapped by the library and the jury. The book is not just about New York City. It engages with questions of right and wrong, humane and inhumane, the prison at Guantanamo Bay. And so for you to honor it at this time and in this way is a truly brave act in itself. And I thank you dearly. It also took real bravery on the part of Viking Penguin to publish my novel, and so I need to thank my brilliant editor, Liz Van Hoos, who's here somewhere, and Seth Fishman at the Gerner Company. If it weren't for them, I would not be here, and we would not have a book. Lastly, I want to thank my parents, who are also here, because they would let me go into Manhattan by myself at a young age. And from Staten Island, I would take the ferry and go into, Battery Park and sit on a bench and look at the harbor and take out my little notebook and write something down and then go to the movies. And my life hasn't really changed that much since. But I'm fortunate. I'm very fortunate. But I mention this only because I'm going to read a small passage from the beginning of the novel where it only just occurred to me as I was thinking about what to say and read here tonight, but my relationship and discovery of the city from a young age was integral to the way I wrote about New York. And so I'll read briefly from that part now. My first day in America was the most eye-opening day of my life. I never had any foul intentions, especially toward the city that took me into her unbiased arms, wrapped me up in her warm September skin, and gave me a big maternal smooch. New York City was a utopia. From the arrival terminal at JFK, I directed my cabbie to drive me to the foot of Manhattan, Battery Park. I had studied my maps. I had always dreamed of seeing the Statue of Liberty on my first day in America, no matter how impractical it was from my point of arrival. I wanted it to be part of my first memory, just like in the immigrant narratives I had read as a teenager. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I was being sentimental, I know, but seeking out Lady Liberty was my way of christening myself an American and a New Yorker to boot. We hit the Van Wyck, which took us through an unsavory part of Queens. Now, from what I saw of it, Queens was a desolate place, much unlike what I would come to know as the city proper. Panel homes gave way to industrial factories. On-ramp gave way to on-ramp. It wasn't until we rolled along the BQE, passing a massive cemetery with thousands of ornate tombstones, that I realized Queens, too, had its own filthy beauty. As my taxi approached a little bridge I couldn't pronounce, there it was, Manhattan. The skyline I had glimpsed from the plane when the captain tipped his wing, the skyline I had seen all my life on television and in films, a skyline that was as much a symbol of my dreams in fashion as it was a symbol of America and its financial prowess, a skyline that called out to me, "Come and get it, sucker." The city beckoned me at every pothole struck. I traced a finger along my map as we went over the Williamsburg Bridge, and then Delancey Street, called my driver, where one comes to pick up drunk young fare. He was a knowing guide, pointing out the neighborhoods as we went: Chinatown, Little Italy, Soho, City Hall. We were downtown, cruising along Broadway, entering the north tip of the financial district, Fulton, Church Street, Maiden Lane. Buildings surrounded me on all sides. I could no longer see the sky. Instead of out, the city just went up and up. To my surprise, Battery Park was not shaped like an alkaline Duracell. All those things I saw in the movies regarding New York's hard edge, like the winos, the drugs, the graffiti, the muggings and murders, the racial strife, these weren't anywhere to be found. I did see my first New York bum sprawled out on a park bench. But he was not begging. He was listening to his own portable radio, propped up on a pushcart full of bottles and cans. There were office mates on lunch, men and women flirting with each other behind sunglasses. There were black women cradling white babies, and white women cradling Asian babies. and Asian women cradling Eurasian babies. I hurried past with my luggage to the water's edge. New York Harbor, breathe. The river was a blue-green bayou. I watched a water taxi play chicken with a tugboat while the Staten Island ferry, the John F. Kennedy, came from behind and threatened to crush them both. I leaned my torso out over the railing so I could see Lady Liberty. She was in mourning. A black veil covered her face, yet she held her torch high, uncovered, as if leading a fleet of ships into battle away from industrial New Jersey. I closed my eyes and listened to the choppy water. I leaned out until my feet were lifted off the ground, and I held my balance over the guard railing by my hands and waist alone, floating, surrendering to the harbor. A foghorn blew in the distance where there was only clear sky. I listened. Thank you very much. This is an honor. Thank you.
Joe McKendry is a painter and illustrator whose work has appeared in over 50 publications worldwide, including the New York Times, the London Times, Esquire, Time, and Vanity Fair. As that list suggests, he's a deeply observant artist and also a very witty one. If you want to have some fun sometime, I suggest that you type the words McKendry and Trump into your Google search window and then hit the image button. You'll have fun. The book we honor today is One Times Square, A Century of Change at the Crossroads of the World. It's a book that offers many delights, including, to name just two, the literally dazzling technology behind the famous New Year's Eve ball, and how they got the old Camel cigarette billboard, which I'm sure some of you remember, to blow those giant smoke rings across Broadway. But this book, I have to tell you, did give us a little bit of trouble. Nobody knew quite what to make of it. We looked at the book and thought, oh, it's a kid's book. Look at the big layout, the large pictures, the diagrams, all these drawings, all figures. Not the kind of book a grown-up buys for himself, a kid's book. But then you start reading the words, and, well, it could be for a very advanced, sophisticated kid, one with a really good vocabulary. Great book to read to a kid, but not really a kid's book either, perhaps. But the book refused to get off our list. Month after month, we would meet. We would focus on our more difficult literary books and winnow down the list a bit more. And then someone would say, well, we still haven't made up our mind about this one, have we? The question we couldn't answer was, who is it for? And then finally, at our last meeting, we realized that whatever category it did or did not belong to, it clearly was for us, which is to say for people who are amused and delighted to get the inside story on a great iconic landmark, people who think Times Square is pretty cool, people who love New York City. We like it. We think you're going to like it. And I'm very pleased to give the award to Joe McKendry.
Thanks so much. That was very nice. I guess I should address the Donald Trump thing first. So I was commissioned by Vanity Fair to do an iPad app on Donald Trump's hair, and I drew him bald, and you could draw his hair on, and then you got an award if your was the most creative hair. His hair is real. I did research on it. It's actually real. The other thing is about who the book is for, and the first person I have to thank is David Godin, my publisher, who is here. And I'll talk a little bit about who the book is for in a minute, but there's not a lot of publishers that would publish this kind of book. And you know, Peter and I were talking beforehand, and he said, you know, when they were trying to figure out what category this is, I think this is a book for the author, and it was. It's just, I did it for me, sort of. In any case, I'll try to be a little more short-winded. David took the book on about 10 years ago. I brought the manuscript for my first book to David after it had been rejected by several other publishers, and I brought it to David, who also rejected the manuscript. He didn't actually reject it, but he said it needs work, and he was right. It wasn't very good. But I came back, and he accepted it. And so my deepest gratitude goes to David for just taking a chance on me in the first place. I'll get to Carl next. My super editor, Carl Scarborough, is his imprint is on every page of the book, and it's really a partnership. When you do a book, it's Alex, probably, as you know, your editor, you have some back and forth, and Carl was the best. I mean, he's a stickler for detail, for quality, and he raised the bar and kept me on my toes, and it's a much better book for his having been involved. And then my parents that are here, I think it takes a special kind of courage to send your kid to art school and hope for the best. They did, and they've been very supportive through, those thin years as a struggling artist. So, and it's my mom's first time in New York City since her junior year in high school. And they just saw Times Square today. So, okay, so I do have pictures. Pictures are pretty, so we'll look at them. In terms of finding a subject for the book, I'm a Boston guy. I'm surprised you guys let me in here. I'm a Red Sox fan. But in any case, in searching for a new subject for a book as a visual illustrator, I think about in historical places, the people that passed before, what the lives were like 100 years ago. And Times Square is about the most modern place that I could think of. And as an illustrator, it's just visual candy, And so... And the image in people's heads is so modern, so it's the best subject to turn it on its head and show horses and carriages and dirt roads, and Broadway was Bloomingdale Road. So that's that. I didn't know much about New York, honestly, when I started the book, and it was a good excuse to learn more. Where do I point that thing? Oh, maybe I go the wrong way. Oh, that's a cut-off image. I hope that doesn't happen to all of them. But in any case... I did a little research, and I found this is a great subject. There was a lot of history here, and so I could show, sort of a broad swath of what was happening. But there were a lot of books on Times Square history, and I needed to find a special angle. So with discussions with Carl, I decided on One Times Square. It's the only building from 1904 when it went in. It was called Longacre Square, and the New York Times built this building in 1904, and then it became Times Square. So in the immediate surroundings of Times Square, that's the only building that's surviving. And here you can see the two before and after. It was the second tallest building in the world when it was built. And look, you can see the landscape, and now it's completely dwarfed. This is not what my present state is. If you can maybe imagine what's below there. It's hard to see, but in any case... If you saw the sepia tone, this below the it's totally dwarfing everything that's around it. My inspiration for the book, the layout and content of the book, actually comes from this book, The Little House by Virginia Lee Burton. It's about a house that's out in the country, and then over time, the suburbs move in, and you can see that smog in the background. That's the city. So the little house says, wow, I wonder what it'd be like in the city, and then it finds out. So One Times Square, the same thing happened, but what I really liked about this layout of the book is that as you flip the page, the little house is in the same spot at the same scale, and so I wanted to do that for my book. The challenge was there was no photographer standing in that one same spot every 20 years or so. So that was a little challenging as an illustrator, but I had some experience with perspective. So, but as you can see, as I go through, I wanted people to flip. You kind of have to work at it a little bit. But each chapter heading has the building in the exact same spot. I kind of constructed an architectural perspective and then made sure everything fits, so you can kind of flip back and forth and have everything line up. The other challenge, as an illustrator, was the color, because I'm using black and white photos. So I have to stop because I totally forgot to thank the New York Society Library. Because the reason I thought of that is that the color and the research and that topic of the kids' book, this is the audience I'm most comfortable with. I really enjoy talking to kids, and it's a picture book, so it gets into the kids section, but this is the group that's into history, that's into reading, that's into books, so I was so happy to get this award because it's really, really nice to be recognized by this group. In any case, the research into the illustration was, you know, reading about what color the trolleys were. You know, I had to go back and look at some print images to try to, you know, find out, you know, what if there was a billboard, maybe Wrigley's or something, what the color scheme was, and, you know, do my best to put it in color. So around every 20 years, you see the square at a new place, and I chose more or less 20 years, but I tried to find a year that was important. So, you know, World War II, obviously it goes 1904, 1926, 1945, 1964, where they stripped the original facade and recoated it. There's a headline in a Texas newspaper that's with this image that said "Strip Show in Times Square." So it gives you a feel for, you know, the national reputation. The 1980s, some of the theaters being destroyed. That was 1982. My Plymouth Horizon that my parents passed down to me is in this illustration here. It had a hole in the floor so you could see the road passing. I remember that. But I loved it. And then 2000, and then my vision of the future of Times Square, which I have an ad for a drink that's going to be around in 2050. It's a diet drink called Wastewater in the middle. Ryan Seacrest is in there. He's still hosting. And then floating cars, of course, for the future. So that's it. Thank you.
So now we have James and Carla Murray, New York Knights. And since one picture is worth 1,000 words, and we're going to see some great pictures, I'll try to keep the ratio even lower. We on the committee liked this because it was a very fresh view of a very distinctly New York feature. And it reminds us of the urban beauty all around us that we should be encouraged, if we leave this building, and especially after nightfall, to go out and see for ourselves, because the feature of New York neon lights is everywhere in the city, although perhaps when you read this you will think that it is disappearing from certain neighborhoods. It's still there to be seen and enjoyed. And another thing that we particularly liked about this book is that in addition to these terrific images, the Murrays spoke with the owners or the longtime workers at these establishments that they photographed. And so from them, we got the history of these places, the history of the lights, and the enterprises that they announced. And after you've read some of it, you will realize that this book is an excellent shopping guide and an excellent guide to dining, because it talks about a lot of restaurants that seem extremely interesting once you get inside, as well as what you see from the street. And it has the voices of the people who've known these lights best, who've worked hard to keep them and to keep their businesses going and to keep the lights bright. And inevitably, in every New York book, there is the real estate angle, and we saw how the owners felt so lucky that they owned their buildings and their lights. The renters were all fearful that their leases would expire, the rents would go up, and they'd have to leave. But all of them shared the determination to stay and to maintain their lights. So it was that combination of a bold front, a deep history, hard work, and a passionate hope that we thought epitomized New York and made this such a good choice for us to give a prize to. So please come and tell us more about it.
Well, first, we would like to thank the New York Society Library and Ellen Eisman and the distinguished jury for honoring us with this New York City Book Award. It means a great deal to us because, having documented the city's neighborhood shops during the daylight hours after completing our book storefront, The Disappearing Face of New York, in 2008, we knew we had to continue our journey. And when you think of New York at night, you think of the huge skyline and the big sweeping beauty shots. But we wanted to capture the city the way we experience and love it the best, from the ground. So we wanted to take people like to the corner street, to the little market or to the little coffee shop, and sparkling at night. And we wanted to capture that feeling like late in the evening when all the tourists go home. And many of the businesses that we wanted to document, they didn't make sense to photograph during the daytime because the theory that weren't open for business, you know, such as the Cabaret and Piano Bar Duplex.
Yep. Oh, yeah, we're going to have some slides. Yeah. There we go. There's...
Well, I thought they were keeping going. Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll backtrack for a second. That's our storefront book, which documented the stores like mom-and-pop businesses during the daytime.
That came out...
The large coffee table size book, which is basically the same size as New York Nights, came out in 2009. And then we came out with this, what we call like the mini version, which is basically just a scaled down version of the large format book. So the reason we wanted the mini version is for people to carry it around. As Roger was explaining, New York Nights, he said, oh, it's a great shopping guide. And that's really, it really captures exactly what we wanted to do with the publications. With the storefront book, it was so large that we said, oh, let's get this little edition so people could, you know, kind of walk around the city and find and all experience these places themselves.
And we had chosen Rouse just because of that S.
Right. We're a big fan of typography, and we just love that. It looked like an Elsa Peretti heart to us. So the next image should be Duplex, going back to the speech. Oh, yeah, I think we have the same problem that some of the images got cut off, but yeah, it doesn't matter because most of the signs are above. So this business, Duplex, in Greenwich Village, it really didn't make sense to shoot at night because basically it's not open until the evening. It's a very unique business in that the name Duplex, as explained by the owner, is because it's two stories and it has a piano bar on one level and then another entertainment area on the next level. And then another business which makes sense to shoot at night was Cafe Wa. And that's a live entertainment bar, and it was original stomping ground for Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix. Capturing also the businesses during the day, a lot of them, they didn't look right. Like, it right. just made more sense to photograph them at night because one of the things that gave them their unique beauty was their gorgeous neon signs, which are best seen at night.
And we made a conscious effort to go out as late as the business would allow because we thought there was some intangible feeling that you got shooting, say, at 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning versus, like, 6:30 in the winter when it gets dark so much earlier. So we really wanted to capture the streets empty, as Carla mentioned earlier, and give that, like I said, intangible night feeling that New York gives.
Right. For instance, with White Horse Tavern, which is in the West Village, although it is open during the day and you can get some lunch there and they serve some food as well as the bar being open, that neon sign we just really, really, really loved. And it's very unique in that it's cobalt blue enamel and has really interesting lettering. And the owner told us that that he actually just had the sign overhauled, like he had taken down and reworked electronically because one of the problems that of these neon signs is that they frequently are like on the blink, as like they like to call it. When it rains, because it's all exposed and they're so old, this one being from the 1940s, it short circuits them. So they have to keep on putting money into them to be fixed. In fact, the people who worked on fixing his sign told him, oh, just take the damn thing down and put back, you know, like a fake one. Like, we'll make a
facsimile.
Yeah. Right. You know, with more, I guess, using LED or something like that. And, of course, it wouldn't be that cobalt blue enamel. That can't even, I don't know, you know, right. how many people know how to work with that material anymore. But he was adamant about it. He told us, oh, no, I would never, never, never give up my sign. You know, I'll spend $20,000. Fixing it up before I take that, put it in the trash heap. So
keeping one of those lit against all the elements and all the challenges in New York is really a labor of love, we learned. And it really doesn't make sense cost-wise.
And this, the venereal pastisseria, which is actually very close to where we live in the East Village, that was the. It was the same story with this. It's actually fourth generation owner owning this business, as you can see, since 1894. And again, we see the truck there all the time. Like there's a guy that he commissions to come and. And they'll be like, oh, look, there's an S out, like in the pastisseria, you know. I'll let that truck on by, and sure enough, we'll be walking our dog, and there goes the truck fixing it up.
And in the book, they go all the way down to the street level. I think we're having the same problem as the Times Square book. We worked really hard to get no people in it. We would set up our tripod, wait for hours. We even got a little crazy. I had a Con Ed vest and a helmet, and I would block off parking spots and get out in the street with a whistle, and we got nuts with it. It really got obsessive after a while, and we kind of went crazy.
Especially when it wasn't close. This being so close to where we live, you know, we felt like, oh, we can, if there was something blocking it, we can just go back any old time.
But there were times like we headed out to Harold's for a prescription way out.
Right, which is in
Brooklyn.
It's like
an hour and a half trip from our apartment, and we'd get out there, and two letters were out. Or we'd get out to other ones, and a UPS truck would just be abandoned in front of it, and we'd end up coming back like 6-7 times, and it really became an effort.
It was definitely the project, you could say, was a true labor of love. But one of the things, and here's another. This is a great, great sign. One of my personal favorites, City Island Lobster House.
The little claws blink.
Right. It would be great if we could make a little gif, and you could see them moving. But unfortunately, this neon sign is no longer with us. The business is still alive and well, but because of the Superstorm Sandy, the whole sign, it just was...
Yeah, toppled over.
Toppled over, and that had to be removed. And I don't think that it's going to be replaced. There hasn't been any confirmation from the owner, but... It doesn't look like it's cost-effective, unfortunately.
That one we got on a rainy, Monday night. We went out there, who's going to be on City Island eating? And it was foggy.
Still a lot of people.
It was still crowded.
We went off-season. We wouldn't dare go there in the summer because it's just way too swamped. But, going back to to what we wanted to talk to you about, interviewing the owners and speaking with the people who've managed or owned the store for many, many years really was something we felt was just as crucial to telling our story than the photos themselves. As much as we love the photos, the driving force behind the book became speaking to these owners, because we heard such amazing stories and these interesting facts and figures, and that's what really pushed us to say, okay, we're going to go out at 2:00 in the morning and stand there for an hour and a half waiting for the shot. And this Coney Island Wonder Wheel shot, it's a fascinating story. In speaking with the owner, it's his father had bought the Wonder Wheel as kind of as a wedding gift to his wife, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to buy you a ring so big that everyone in the world is going to see how much I love you." And I thought that was just so touching. And getting this shot it looks like it's cut off again so you can't see the bottom. It looks deceptively simple, and I think that's one of the things that we tried throughout the book. We made it look like it was very easy.
We worked really hard to make it look easy.
Right, yeah, exactly. But if you've ever been to Coney Island, because it's not like you can really go off-season here. We did actually go in the height of the summer, but... It had just pouring rain, so it had cleared out. We knew it was raining, and we said, "Oh, let's take a shot. Maybe it won't be so incredibly busy." Because when we had spoken to the owner on the phone, we said, "Oh, well, what's a good night to come?" And he's like, "Well, if you come on a weeknight when it's less busy, if it's not busy, I might just turn it off and go home." Because he doesn't really have a set hour. He just closes when he feels like closing. He's like, "I can't guarantee that you guys will, come out here from Manhattan and I'll still be around. And I'd love to say I'm going to keep it open for you, but I won't." So We're like, okay, well.
But they were really nice. We were shooting, and we got low behind our tripod, and the place was closing. And
right, because lightning started happening again, and he's like,
I'm gonna. We were so involved, we turned around, like the crew of employees was standing behind us, and they're like, oh, did you get everything you needed? And,
yeah, he was.
And they were really, really nice.
He was really nice. So this, another business back. Going back to a previous slide, we don't have to show it again, but with White Horse Tavern, one of the things that we found out from the current owner was that it was like business as usual there during Prohibition, because it turns out that Jimmy Walker, who was the mayor of New York City at the time, actually drank there often and had given instructions to the local police precinct to leave the place alone. So we thought that was pretty interesting.
And he explained how these are like... these little horse windows tip in, and it was one of the first buildings to like use that for air conditioning.
Right, he said it was like your
predated air conditioning,
state of the art air conditioning at the time,
and they still work.
Right, he said the louvers actually still function, but because he has air conditioning now, he doesn't use them. But that was really another interesting fact. Old Homestead's steakhouse that you see in this slide, which opened in 1868, when it opened, you can splurge on an entire meal of sirloin steak with salad and sides for 8 cents. And now just the same meal, just for the steak alone, is $50. So we thought that was pretty interesting. And it's changed so much, that area. But they own the building, so you don't have to worry. They're there to stay. This business, which is also close to where we live, Theater 80 St. Mark's, this was probably one of the most fascinating stories from the owner that we've heard. I mean, he literally spent hours with us, and he took us like on a full tour of the place. And the interesting fact on this place was a couple of things, but his father, the current owner, his father found $2 million in a 1928 gold certificates like locked inside a safe that they found in the basement. And it turned out that it was like from a former mobster that had kind of like run a speakeasy in the place during Prohibition. By the way, when they found the safe, they called the person that they had bought it from because they knew he had been mobbed up, and he didn't give them not even 1 cent. Like, he just put all the money in a bag and...
Yeah, it disappeared.
He disappeared. But they stayed alive, so that was...
Yeah.
That was,
yes.
That they said, that's fine. But also, he told us that Frank Sinatra was a singing waiter there in 1949, so we thought that was a little interesting fact. The next slide, it got cut off at the bottom, but this is C.O. Bigelow Pharmacy in Greenwich Village is the oldest apothecary in America, and it was founded in 1838, and Mark Twain actually had his prescriptions filled there. And they have, if you go inside, if you ask nicely, they have a book, and they'll take out, and they can show you the receipt from one of his purchases, so that's kind of neat. The 21 Club in Midtown was favored by literary figures such as Robert Benchley, Dorothy Parker, and Alexander Wolcott, and had an elaborately disguised secret door downstairs that led to the adjacent building, and that's where they hid like 200 crates of wine during Prohibition from the police. So when the place was raided, they would just, okay, lock that door up, and nobody ever figured out where all their stuff was being hidden. So they stayed in business. And the Apollo, of course, in Harlem, we love their, this neon sign is not the original. This was redone when the Apollo was redone, but it's redone in such a convincing way that we felt, it was definitely deserving of being in the book. But it's very interesting history too. James Brown and Ella Fitzgerald and Dionne Warwick's career were all launched after successful performances there.
And that marquee in the front that says "Welcome to the Apollo Theater," we waited for a long time to get both of those to flash that same image.
Oh, right.
With no cars driving in front and with people, so that became a mission as well.
Yeah, that was. We were there for a while. It was a cold night too. So these are just some of the examples of different businesses that while interviewing the owners, we found and doing research about the history of the establishments that. we thought people would enjoy. Also, we wanted to shoot, like I said before, just like the regular everyday man's place. And this is a perfect example, just a regular coffee shop that maybe somebody that if you didn't venture into this neighborhood, you would never even know about. And certainly you might walk just right by it and not even think about it. But it's kind of like the unsung heroes we wanted
that part of Fabric to stand next to the Radio Cities and the Apollo. And then you turn the page and there's a food cart, and you turn the page and there's,
food cart. Yeah.
And show that as well.
And then I think there's a regular liquor store as well. So not only that do we photograph like the iconic institutions and these generation-old shops, but also the regular everyday man businesses. And unfortunately, since the book was published, which is December, I think, is the official pub date, 12 of the businesses in the book have already closed. And many have fallen victim to rent increases due to real estate, prices going up. The landlords, when their long-term lease expires, they are forced to either sign very short-term leases, 1, 2, or 3 years leases, and at extraordinary rates. In fact, Lenox Lounge in Harlem is such an example of that. That just closed December 31st, and there's hope that it might reopen because the owner of the business did take the neon sign and did take, the zebra print wallpaper and all these things from inside. But there's a fight going on right now because the person that is, renting the spot actually wanted all that stuff. Like, he wanted to recreate his own Lenox Lounge, but the guy took it with him because he had every right to do so.
That was one of the ones when we shot, we felt would always be there.
And right. We never honestly thought that was going anywhere. I mean, it had been there for so long. And,
that's why, like, when we compiled our daytime book, 2/3 of that book are gone by now.
Yeah, we wrote the introduction in 2008, and when we wrote the introduction, 1/3 of the businesses had already closed, and now it's pushing 2/3. It's very, very sad. Basically, we hope that this book will help preserve an important part of New York and bring awareness to the unique characters that these businesses bring to the streets and neighborhoods of the city, and their illuminated facades and their lights, what makes it New York so special. Also, we hope as readers that you will actually go to the businesses and frequent them because they do need your business, and hopefully they'll be alive for many more years to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's my job now to close the event. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's wonderful to have so many people here tonight. It was the place to be in the Upper East Side tonight, obviously. We're so proud to be a library that supports publishing and publishing in the print format. I'm really glad that the publishers who are involved with these books are here tonight because I think it's very important for them to be here with their writers. So thank you for coming, the folks from the publishing company. So congratulations once again to all of our winners. I have to thank the jury as well. They've done an awful lot of work in the last year. They've read a lot of books, a lot of them very, very good, and a lot of them that they would put in a different category, probably. But I also want to thank our chair of the jury, Roger Pasquier, who is stepping down as chair this year. He's done yeoman's service on the jury. And thank you, Roger, for all your work in the last year. I'd like to thank Jenny Lawrence once again for her support in providing the Hornblower Award, and to Ellen Eisman for underwriting this evening. This is a night when we also like to feed you a little bit and provide wine. So stay, enjoy yourselves, meet the authors, and you can buy copies of the books outside from our friends from the Corner Bookstore, and we don't have a deadline to get out of here, so enjoy yourselves. Thanks for coming.